Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Annabel Patterson, who is a Sterling Emeritus Professor of English at Yale University and who is the 2008 Tanner Lecturer on the Berkeley campus. Annabel, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in England, raised in the home counties, horse country, refused to ride. That's probably good. A sign of later intransigence. My parents were sort of ordinary upper middle class people who put the stress on the upper when they define themselves.
And looking back, how do you think they shaped your thinking about the world?
Partly because they sent me to a really, really good school. It was the Cheltenham Ladies' College, which was one of the two academic schools for girls at that time, a sort of feeding ground for the women's colleges. And partly because I didn't like their opinions. And I intuitively found myself distancing myself from them.
And what was the conversation like at the dinner table? I mean, did you argue about what? Politics or?
Never.
Yes.
Those were the days in England that certain subjects were completely taboo. Sex, religion, and politics were taboo. But you picked up nuances of political views, and I found a good deal of it offensive, though I wasn't consciously analyzing it at the time. I just knew I was uncomfortable.
And what did having rejected horses and riding, did you turn to books early in your life?
Well, I'm going to tell this little anecdote, which I formulated later to explain the relationship between things. Whenever I went to a dance, young men would come up to me, and we would start dancing, and they would say, "Do you hunt?" And I would say, "No." And then they would say, "Well, do you ride?" Mm-hmm. And I would say, "No." And it was only after I had grown up and left the country that I realized the appropriate reprise should have been, "Do you read?"
And many of them may have said no.
They would have had to say no.
So this women's school that you went to, was it a preparatory school for college?
Well, it wasn't described as that. It was an advanced academic school for girls taught by blue stockings of some of them of some distinction.
And did you have any particular teachers there that really inspired you looking back, or was it just the whole curriculum?
No, it was the rigor of the whole curriculum, and there was one in particular whom I seem to remember, so it must have been influential. We used to call her Auntie Clark. She was a funny little wizened old lady with pencils stuck in her bun, and she taught me Latin. Mm-hmm. And I learned to love Latin and to understand the place of the word in the sentence or the line of verse. So I think that must have had something to do with where I am now.
Mm-hmm. And then where did you do what we call undergraduate work before you went?
I was a little young, but I was put through the applications for Oxford and Cambridge, and the results came back, "She's too young, let her try again next year." So I said, "Poo on that." I'm not going to go through this again. My parents tried various options and ended up sending me to secretarial school in London. And then they ended up sending me to Baring Brothers Bank in London as a secretary, because that's where my father had worked before he became a farmer. And So I did not go to college in England. Instead, I ran away with the collusion of my parents from this whole culture and went to Canada.
Mm-hmm. What, just out of curiosity, was this a period when women really had to struggle,
I guess,
to get access to the academic training places that they really merited?
Well, there were two women's colleges at each of Oxford and Cambridge as compared to, let us say, 20 male colleges. And it wasn't only that. It was what happened after you'd been to college. That was the hard part. Mm-hmm. There weren't any jobs for women.
So where did you go in Canada?
So I emigrated to Toronto, still thinking I was in the business world. Mm. And I landed fortuitously in an academic family. And there, for the first time in my life, I experienced conversations.
I see.
The children were in the University of Toronto, and we had passionate conversations every night over dinner about things like politics. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, a whole new world.
Yeah. And what when you say politics, was it Canadian politics? Was it world politics? And also, was literature on the table?
Oh, absolutely.
Books that you had read, yeah.
Yes. And music and art. And so I had a crash course, really, in a more advanced culture than I'd had at home. And so then I wrote my parents, and I said, I'm going to go to college. Mm-hmm. And they wrote back and said, whatever for.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's very good. Now, you're a person who looks at society to understand words and intellectual process. I'm curious, what is the comparison here between your experience at home versus in what happened in Canada? Was it just the peculiarities of the two different families?
That was the chance part of it, yes. But it was a more energetic society than the one from which I came. And the real story is that I had wanted to emigrate to America, which in my mind was the place I should have been born in. But my parents
that's good.
My parents persuaded me that I should go to Canada as a halfway house. And that's exactly how it operated. Mm-hmm. I spent 20 years there, becoming a much more thoughtful and active person. Did quite a bit of political work, running people's campaigns for the New Democratic Party.
Let's talk about that. That is interesting. So Canada, this halfway house, is that the correct word? This transition place, essentially opened you up to all these possibilities, and helped you realize your potential.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I enrolled in the University of Toronto and suddenly discovered I could do this. I was really, really good at it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you major in?
I majored in English literature.
In English literature, and I guess you, as you were majoring, you were involved in all sorts of campus activities and so on.
But mostly, I should say, the political activities in which certain groups of students were involved. Now, this is nothing like this was 58. To 62, so it's not the 60s.
Yeah.
But there were some really smart people in the college in which I was enrolled, which was the non-denominational college, where all the Jews congregated.
I see.
And they were just active in local, provincial, and federal elections. Mm-hmm. It was just very exciting.
Now, as one looks at the body of your work and listens to your lectures, I mean, you were really drawn to politics as a background. But so I'm curious, why did you stay in English? Was that just your first passion?
Well, it was a passion, but it was also the thing that I excelled in. Whereas in politics, I was just a hanger-on or, you know, ran the committee rooms and things like that. But the literature stuff just seemed to be my bent, and so you follow your bent.
Wait, did you witness the transition of women in politics? Because I would, in this period, were women still kind of secondary
yes.
to the game? I mean,
yes.
Yeah, because one knows that was true here even in the 60s.
In everything.
Yeah.
Not just in politics, but within the university, within the university administration. So it would take 10 years from the point where I entered a Canadian university for there to be a serious sort of feminist movement that put some people to shame.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because on a personal level, it sounds like you went on a journey here earlier in your life that opened up possibilities
yes.
as an individual,
yes,
basically. But then, you know, with the 60s comes a kind of initial efforts to opening up the broader social structure. So you must have been very sensitive to that, not only as a woman, but as somebody who's had this experience you just described.
Well, I don't know how aware I was of what was going on in my head, to tell you the truth. I just was always busy doing more things than I should have been. Mm-hmm. And so I ran my university career. I did quite a lot of political organizing. My ex-husband and I, my second ex-husband mm-hmm. and I, created the Ontario Tenants Association from mm-hmm. scratch because we lived in a building which was exemplary of all that was wrong between landlords and tenants. Mm-hmm. And that was perhaps the most fun organizing of anything I've ever done.
And where did this kind of interest in politics come from?
I don't know.
You there was something was there to be done.
Yes.
Yeah, and you seized the opportunity.
Yes.
Where did you do your graduate work?
I did that at the University of London in England, which, as you perhaps know, at that stage didn't mean doing graduate work. It meant sitting in the British Library. But actually, it meant sitting at home with my baby and going to the British Library once a week. Mm-hmm. And you could barely talk your way into a class. Things have changed now. There mm-hmm. there is actually graduate instruction in English universities, but there wasn't then.
And what did you do a dissertation
yes.
for your degree, and what was your dissertation on?
Well, I did a dissertation on Sir Thomas Wyatt, a very early 16th century poet who had an interesting political career of his own.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very standard stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I did
Please, go ahead.
And then I did another dissertation because that... Here's another story about women. That my advisor thought that this would qualify as a PhD, but when it was presented, the application was presented, the board said, "Oh, she's too young, and she's a woman, and we think that she should count this for an MA and then do a PhD afterwards." Well, okay.
So I just did it.
Yeah. I just did it.
And what was the second one?
The second one took me into different territory again because it took me into ancient Greek rhetoric.
Hmm.
And I found a particular Greek rhetorician who intrigued me because he was not well known. A very esoteric, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And never mind, I got it done one summer. Mm-hmm. So when I eventually came to work in, you know, a professional graduate school as a teacher, my most frequent comment was about the students, what do they do with their time?
I see. The body of your work is very impressive, and we're obviously not going to have time to, you know, go into as much as we could do 10 hours of interviews, which we're not. We're only going to do 1 hour. So I guess what I want to start with is what do you see as the skills required to do what you do, and what is it you do? I mean, you are a humanist, you are a literary scholar, but when one looks at any of your works, you're also a historian and somebody who's very interested, concerned about, and writes about social forces.
So how do you manage to combine those things?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I think my mantra is keep asking questions. Mm-hmm. Never be satisfied with what you're told. And a number of my books have arisen out of dissatisfaction with, as it were, the orthodox position on things. The book on Shakespeare was one such.
And this book is the Shakespeare and the Populist.
And the Popular Voice, right.
The Popular Voice.
And that came out of a dissatisfaction with everybody's belief that Shakespeare was essentially contemptuous of the popular voice, of the common man, of the many-headed multitude. And I knew that it was more complicated than that, and set out to demonstrate that.
Mm-hmm. This questioning, before we go on with the other skills, this questioning, this harkens back to the dinner table.
Yes, indeed. So never be satisfied with what appears to be the consensus around you. And if anything strikes you as odd, look further into it. Mm-hmm. And keep on looking. And that means you have to learn about new areas. You have to go in with great temerity, actually, into areas that you're not supposed to know anything about, like history.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the Shakespeare book, let me not ask a naive question. Why is it important to know what Shakespeare thought about the general population? And I'm asking this because we know it is important, and there's a struggle here about the meaning of where he stood. Why is that important?
The question is, why is there a struggle?
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things I learned gradually as I matured was that literary studies are, on the whole, and have been over time, deeply conservative, and have preferred conservative readings, interpretations of their most famous iconic figures. So it was important for people to think, the gentleman scholars who were Shakespeareans, that Shakespeare was like them, and even if he was an autodidact, he quickly became contemptuous of the people in his village, whatever. Now, of course, I exaggerate, but the same kind of struggle goes on over the body of Milton. And it's not bad that it does. What it does is keep the ball rolling, keep the interest up. Mm-hmm. But the real question is, why should it matter to a literature scholar or a literary work what political views or social views the author had? Right?
Right.
Why should it? Well, some people say firmly it shouldn't and doesn't. Mm-hmm. And the best writers put that stuff beneath them or behind them.
And this,
and of
even
course, that's not true.
Yeah, and this goes to extremes in the sense that recently a generation has said, well, it's only the words that matter. It's just the text.
Right.
So it's a total decontextualization.
Right. Yeah. And I always hated that. I thought that was effete and self-indulgent, because you could then make it say anything you wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was my objective to try and empirically determine what you could and couldn't say about a writer based on something we might or might not call facts.
Mm-hmm. When you say conservative, the in the case of Shakespeare, for example, there was a prevailing conservative. Mm-hmm. What do you mean, conserving the received opinion, supportive of contemporary interests, or what?
Supportive of the monarchy.
Yeah.
supportive of class distinctions. That'll do for Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. In the case of Milton, was he a Republican? If so, when? Did he repent of being a Republican when he wrote Paradise Lost, which a whole school of Miltonists have to claim in order to be able to continue to admire him? Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is that we judge, whether we should or not, we judge writers by whether we can see that their views are compatible with ours.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've talked enough about your background to give us an indicator of what pushed you in the direction of being the questioner and the one who questioned establishment views of what an artist had contributed. But was it being in politics, which you said you were, that also furthered this perspective with which you would address these questions?
Well, it may have been, but it may have been a parallel development. Mm-hmm. And let me pause for a moment to think this through. The first book in which I tried to perhaps use some of my new political sensitivity was a book on Andrew Marvell. And I was just struck by the fact that two-thirds of what Marvell wrote was omitted or depreciated by people who had written about him before me. And I thought, wait a minute, this is weird, and let's see what this stuff is like. And the reason that they had omitted it or depreciated it was because it was the political two-thirds of his career. He was a member of parliament. He wrote political satires. He engaged in debates on toleration. But English literature people didn't want to have anything to do with that. So I wrote a book that said they should.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've covered so many topics. Somewhere here I have a list of the things that you have done. And just to give our audience a sense of that, English Renaissance poetry, rhetoric, the history of censorship, the reception of classical texts, historiography, and especially early modern political thought, and then in your Tanner lectures, American issues. How did you move from topic to topic, basically? In other words, did an ongoing work raise questions and led off onto another path? Because it's such a broad range of interests.
I think that serendipity has a huge amount to do with the choice of the next topic. And one of my pieces of advice to graduate students is never do the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. So don't go back and do more Shakespeare or more Milton, which is always what they ask you to do. But think of something completely different. Mm-hmm. If you want the blood to keep flowing.
That goes against the prevailing wisdom, doesn't it?
Of course it does. Yeah. But it means you end up knowing more. Mm-hmm. And then you ask yourself, when you get to my age, where's all that knowledge going to go? Mm-hmm. It's going to end up in a little casket of ashes.
Oh, gee.
I think about this frequently. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I keep on writing books in order to prevent the disappearance of what I know and to make it available to people. I'm just saying that there's something counterintuitive about the drive for more knowledge, as an end in itself, but it's one to which I'm utterly subject.
Mm-hmm. But the journey makes the life worthwhile, even though you have no control over what future generations
results
would do.
The journey has been unbelievably satisfying, and I regard myself as completely spoiled.
Mm-hmm. Anything else about the work that you do, questioning, you've talked about, moving to different topics, any other insight about what it takes to do what you do? Obviously, you have to have a wit, or at least the way you're doing it, because that is very clear your sense of irony and your wit come to play.
Well, that just comes with the territory. That's just luck, right? Mm-hmm. I have sharp eyes. I have sharp eyes for observing what has not been said and done. Or I'm a fast reader. When I read something, I can see something on the page that might be worth discussing. That's a very lucky talent to possess, and it's very difficult to teach other people to acquire it. Very sharp eyes. Mm-hmm. I love detailed work. Mm-hmm. I'm offended by very broad generalizations and high theory. Mm-hmm. And I see, looking back now, that as I age, I become more detailed, which probably means more pedantic.
Mm-hmm. But not necessarily.
Not necessarily, sure. as long as the subject is still worth it.
Yeah.
But let me give you an example. My most recent book, which is now sitting in proof on my bed back at the Women's Faculty Center, is something I was encouraged to do by being given a Mellon Emeritus Fellowship. And in order to apply for such a fellowship, I had to come up with a topic. Well, the first topic I came up with turned out to be hopeless. I wanted to work on the hospice movement in the United States. And then I discovered that HIPAA, the Patient Confidentiality Act, made that impossible. So in a flash, I proposed an alternative topic, which was to write about the Restoration Parliament, which I'd realized had never been fully written about. That is the Parliament of Charles II. So I then spent hours and hours and hours reading parliamentary debates and pamphlets about the period and training myself in actually quite a specialized subfield of history. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it. And because I came from literature, I could see things that political historians could not see. Or weren't interested in, or didn't value.
So literature for you and working in literature is a way to broaden your horizons, whereas generally in the academy, it can turn into narrowing
your
horizons.
Yes, indeed. And we have a terrible tendency to encourage narrowing as a form of professionalization in our graduate students. Plus, it's a form of laziness too. If you don't have to work the whole area up again, if you think you know it.
Well, one of your first major books, which I looked at, and I'll show to our audience, Censorship and Interpretation. Let's take a little time to talk about that, because it's really about seeing how authors deal with their situation, their political and social context, and how they come to write and what they write about. And this theme actually is in other of your books.
You
have a book on Aesop's
Fables.
Yes, yeah. So how did you come to that, and what did you find there that was most interesting?
You know, again, by accident, both institutional accident and personal, because I was in the middle of a much larger project. I was writing a book on the reception of Virgil's eclogues from the beginning to the 20th century, to World War II. And I was asked to become chair of the Maryland English Department. Well, common sense told me that I couldn't seriously continue work on this quite demanding project, which meant working in several languages while I was attending to the business of the department. So I thought, well, what have I got? And in fact, I had two or three essays already written and not committed, which could have been brought together, but seemed to have a common theme. But the thing that really set it off, gave me the title, I guess, was a trial record that I was reading for quite other reasons, a 17th century trial of William Prynne by the Caroline, I want to say Privy Council, but it wasn't. It was the court whose name I can't come up with, for having written a book, Histriomastics, it was called, that was thought to insult the Queen of England. And it wasn't the fact that he was being tried for that completely unthinkable. I mean, that it would be, one would be tried today in the United States for writing a book insulting George Bush is unthinkable. It was the way the trial was conducted and what was said and reported in the trial transcript that interested me. Because Prynne's judges said, it's all very well to say you didn't mean that, but it's how it's read that counts. And if it's capable of bearing that meaning, then you must take the blame. And so they cut off his ears. It's a famous case, but usually people have concentrated on the punishment rather than on the trial. And so I realized that the issue was, if you were a writer in a culture where there was no freedom of speech, no freedom of the media at all, how you continued to write and speak in a way that would keep you out of trouble.
And this leads to a very interesting discussion of the way the writer is affected and the way he adapts to rules, you know, with the goal of not having ears cut off, but make an important point.
Well, the way he creates, here's a standard way, where he creates fictions that serve as his defense. So if anybody challenges him, he can say, but that's only a fiction. And you can see I'm not mentioning names. Or the way he refers to classical texts that have been known for years to bear certain meanings and can be reapplied to the current situation, and so on. But in that book, I developed a thesis, which I'm not sure I any longer believe, that there was a compact, a contract between the writers and the authorities, that as long as you did veil your criticism sufficiently, you would be allowed to make it. And there were sort of all sorts of unspoken rules about veiling. Recently, I've just been working on the Federal Theater Project in the 30s and reading an absolutely fascinating book about the Federal Theater and the kinds of censorship that the playwrights were subjected to in the 30s by the people who were funding the project.
And this would have been the federal government.
This is the federal government and the people in charge of...
Under the New Deal.
And that gives me a whole new set of insights, which I, at some point I want to bring back to bear on what it was like in the earlier period. Go ahead.
This edition that I have has a new introduction, which was written at the time of after the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on. And I think this is a very important point because you go, you do this digging, and your capacity to do that leads you to uncover these pearls. But what's kind of interesting is they have both comparative meaning, you're just talking about English history, and they have a contemporary meaning. So in the introduction here, you're talking about the modes of operation of Václav Havel during the under the communist regime, writing plays, but making points and in a way being in a dialogue with the authorities and also the world and the Czech people.
Well, you know, this subject keeps on going. There is such a thing as the Encyclopedia of Censorship, which I think has something like three volumes, and I I possess them because I made a couple of contributions. And you have no idea how many interesting instances there are of censorship in the modern world, as well as, of course, in the ancient and the early modern world. And one could spend one's life on that. But then I decided to do something different.
Now, just one other point on censorship, because it fleshes out, I think, our understanding of what's going on in the world today. And here I'm not talking about what may be happening in say, the United States, but rather what we've come to call this clash of worlds,
yes,
clash of civilizations, because it then becomes very important to understand what we stand for and how it has come about and how that must be compared what has happened in other parts of the world. I'm not trying to push you into this ideological conflict, but rather just to show that you as you think about censorship in the way that you think about it, it has relevance for the Salman Rushdie case.
Of course
that
it does.
One at least has to think about.
Of course it does, but I think the Salman Rushdie case is atypical in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And, what I see as our dilemma as American intellectuals, a fancy word for people who think, is that America claims to be the free world,
mm-hmm,
in which things like censorship don't occur,
mm-hmm,
and therefore can set itself in righteous indifference against what it sees as the theocracy in the Middle East. Now, if you've read Kevin Phillips' Theocracy, you know there's one here too. And I think people like me have an obligation to keep on thinking about what the new rules of communication are between the different sides of the world. And my goal, were I in that business, which I'm not, would be to try and get people to see that actually, there's not that much difference between, for instance, forcing women to wear veils, which is a form of censorship, and in the States recently taking away the children of a polygamous sect because our government doesn't believe in polygamy. So I won't go on with that, but that's, I think, once one's learned to sort of pick one's examples from all over the place, the clear distinction between the West and the East disappears. Now, of course, I don't want to go too long with this point, of course there have been regimes, particularly in Pakistan, where one could see the operations of a more formal censorship and perhaps look down on it and perhaps not look down on it.
Mm-hmm. You're interested in other forms of media, and before we go off of this topic on censorship, I'm just curious, because one of the interesting phenomena in the United States was during this period after 9/11,
yes,
the only place one could find analysis in the media was on the programs of comedy, the Jon
yes.
Stewart, the Stephen Colbert.
Right.
So in a way, the censorship had been institutionalized across media, so things were not being talked about, and it was only through humor and satire. Yeah.
Well, actually, that's a point that I make in censorship and interpretation, that often you can get away with really quite extreme criticism of the regime if the way you put it is funny.
Mm-hmm.
I think Michael Moore is an example of that. Fahrenheit 9/11, which, by the way, takes its title, as I'm sure you know, from a famous film about the burning of books.
Mm-hmm. By Bradbury.
The
original book.
Which is a perfectly serious and slightly tragic film. But what Michael Moore has grasped is that you can allude back to that era of repression, which was, I guess, a Cold War fantasy or phantom, in such a funny way that all sorts of people are going to go, A, watch your film, and B, be influenced by it against their own predilections. Mm-hmm. Humor is amazing in that respect.
Your Tanner lectures, let's move to them, because what we're talking about here is the power of words and a particular subset of words, abstract nouns.
Yes.
How they affect our lives, the power they have over them, and how we have to think about them in order to have power over the words. So briefly, what do you mean by these key words, these abstract nouns that you're focusing on?
Well, the term keywords is, of course, derived from a book by Raymond Williams, who was a social philosopher in Britain and a very left-wing social philosopher. And his book is still enormously influential among social scientists today, because he pointed to the fact that language is not just a tool, it's exerts an influence on its hearers and readers. And the more skills you have in the wielding of that tool, the more influence you'll have. I began with the concept of keywords and with the idea of updating Williams, though not in the way he's been updated by his followers, by looking at words that were really potent in America.
And you identify three words in your second lecture.
Yes.
And what are they?
Marriage. Mm-hmm. Success and democracy. And the case for choosing those three and only those three is, first of all, that they're very different, so you can have a more interesting discussion, bringing in very different blocks of past information. And secondly, that they have long biographies.
The words.
The words themselves mm-hmm. have long biographies. Now, the thought of a word having a biography is a little strange, but a linguist would call that doing historical semantics, seeing how the word has been used over time and how it's been changed, how its meanings have changed. Mm-hmm. But I make a further argument, not that you can just trace the biography of a word, but the longer the biography it is, the more powerful the word is likely to be. Mm-hmm. I haven't fully articulated this yet, the theory of that, and maybe I will when I revise the lectures, but it seems to me self-evident.
Mm-hmm. And in the case of each of these words, they have and have come to have special meaning in America. which you understand in the way de Tocqueville understood
yes.
it. That you know, you focus on his work and especially his definitions of democracy. But it's also true of the other words. They're kind of open to definition, and that the redefinition through time reflects the social forces and the history at
yes.
work. As they rise. And in a way, I think you're saying that these are terribly important words today, and they are high in America's hierarchy of words.
Yes. Now, I would be happy to argue with anybody who says they're not the only ones or the highest ones, or they're not what I would have chosen. But that seems to me a conversation worth having, because it requires a way of thinking. One has to do a different sort of mental exercise to challenge my selection and to defend one's own selection, mm-hmm. right? And when I was giving the lecture experimentally to some of my colleagues at Yale, to some social scientists, one of them said to me, "Do tell the Berkeley people." Do tell them. When you talk about one word being more powerful than another, or more abstract than another, tell them to listen to their mind and listen what their mind is doing when they assess that claim. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to make a counterclaim, listen to what their mind is doing in order to produce that counterclaim. Mm-hmm. Now, I need to do more work on that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm of the three words, I know least about the term marriage. Mm-hmm. And by delving into the history, what one knows that word by virtue of one's own marriage, but then what's going on politically right now. But the history is extraordinarily rich, especially if you go back to Roman time.
That's only a half of it. I mean, it cut out huge swathes. That was originally a whole chapter.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the interesting parts of the chapter is the way in which Genesis, the book of Genesis, is cited over and over again by proponents of marriage in its traditional form as what God said about marriage, which is patently untrue. That is, even if you believe that Genesis is the word of God in some sense, which of course I don't, it's not even true that in Genesis God said the words about marriage. Mm-hmm. So if you read it as a text, it has been misread, deliberately misread, I would say, by people who talk about bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh and those are Adam's words, mm-hmm. not God's.
Mm-hmm. So it's really and the interesting thing about these keywords is when they come to prevail at a moment in time in history, all of that is obscured. What you're describing basically, because it's really how the word is truly an abstract noun.
Yes.
So a lot of the multiple meanings from the past, how the meanings have changed over time, are really obscured. They're not on the table.
They're not on the table. And what happens instead is that current thought is not majority thought anymore, but current thought from a large body of Americans, which is, you may call it the religious right, loops back and inserts itself in its own vocabulary into the word marriage, which they claim subsumes and always has subsumed their own values. Mm-hmm. I like the looping back theory, and you can see it happening.
So there is, as we discussed earlier, a power struggle here.
Yes.
About which will prevail at a particular time.
Yes. And one knows, interestingly, which will prevail. That is to say, the history of the word marriage in its pattern of increased secularization, even though there may be a reactionary phase or two, itself requires, you see where I'm going, that ultimately same-sex marriage will have to be exactly the same as heterosexual marriage.
Now the word, another word you look at is success, as I recollect from your lecture, originally it started with a military meaning, basically.
No, originally it started with a completely neutral meaning.
Neutral, okay.
So, you could say, I am going to London and I hope to have a successful visit.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often, of course, it had a military meaning, but it originally just meant that which happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to put the word good in front of it in order to inflect it with our positive meaning of success.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got Americanized because of the enormous expansion of the American economy and its dominance of the world. It annexed the word, the American economy, if you like.
Mm.
Not that an economy can annex anything, but people who thought in those terms, like Emerson, annexed the word success with some doubts to what had been happening to American wealth, with American wealth.
And the word success, as you trace its evolution, really gets implicated with the Horatio Alger myth, with Americans' definition of what the good life was,
yes,
and what one had to do and what one had to buy,
yes,
for there to be the good life.
Which, of course, is absolutely the case now. Mm-hmm. If you think about how people are being asked to evaluate right now where they stand in relation to the economy and whether they're better off, mm-hmm, than they were 10 years ago, what is going through their mind is, what do I own? Mm-hmm. Can I send my kids to college? Do we both, husband and wife, have to keep working at one job even each, or two jobs even, mm-hmm, each? So that probably, if you asked the man on the street, the woman on the street, what success means today, would be what they would first think of as a way to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Third word is democracy,
yes,
which seems to be critical in the sense of it implicates both our understanding of our own political system and its success or
yes,
failure and how we realize it, but also it's become part of the assemblage of words that we use to justify our empire abroad.
Now, is that a question or a statement?
Well, it's an assertion which I want you to shoot down, because it almost seems that it has become very important if you link it to democratization,
as soon as you create the sub word democratization, mm-hmm, you've done something.
Okay, so I've created a new word.
Well, it has been created before you, but as soon as you use it, mm-hmm, you acknowledge that it was a term required by the current American government. Mm-hmm. And preceding American governments, but especially this one, to justify intervention in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It being the assumption, mm-hmm, that they didn't have democracies over there, even though they might have elections. They didn't have the right kind of democracies. And so it was our job as a country to impose that system on them. Mm. But of course they would say, encourage them to develop it themselves.
Mm-hmm. If one looks at these three words, it struck me that they will be important barometers of where this country goes. In other words, as the definition,
yes,
changes in this period that we're in now, where we're seeming to have to come to grips with our decline internationally, the decline of our,
yes,
economy, and so on. So there's going to, especially the two, success and democracy.
Yes.
Those words are going to be changing.
Well,
as
even
we,
yeah, even marriage too.
Yeah.
You know, by the year 2010, my bet is that the word marriage will no longer be as contested as it is, and that its meaning will have been clarified as meaning essentially a synonym for civil union,
mm-hmm,
legal civil union, mm-hmm, with certain consequences.
Mm-hmm. And the word success, one might anticipate that it will take on more ethical dimensions as people have to reconcile themselves to a less materialist kind of existence without the large houses.
Exactly. Well, success in the success literature, it has always contained that element of, as I say, moral doubt,
mm-hmm,
as to whether the American version of success, the bitch goddess version, is the one we should be encouraging. But the doubt has always been overwhelmed, mm-hmm, by the possibility, mm-hmm, of success in the financial sense. And I would say the increasing laxity of our government regulation as to how far success may be allowed to go in financial terms.
Mm-hmm.
When Roosevelt reined in the corporations, something changed temporarily in the meaning of success. Mm-hmm. In the 1980s, under Reagan, it changed again, and I would say in a reactionary way. Mm-hmm. And I'm betting that at the end of this economic cycle, it will not permanently, but temporarily, acquire another layer of sophisticated thinking mm-hmm. about what it is we're doing here.
And the term democracy, we may be on the threshold with the Obama campaign of redefining what that means. That is, democracy again finding its roots in the grassroots, basically.
Well, I will confess instantly that I am an obsessive Obama follower. So the audience should know that I am not a neutral person at all. I am impressed not by Obama's rhetoric about grassroots movement, but by his success mm-hmm. in creating it. And you do know he was an organizer in Chicago. That's one of the credentials he brings to the floor, as it were. So my heart goes out to him at that level, because that's what I used to do in a much, much more timid mm-hmm. and safe way. Grassroots is an extraordinary phenomenon. It's in itself an abstract noun phrase. And what it means is relatively clear, mm-hmm. but its value, that is, its evaluation in our scheme of values, changes decade by decade. And that's just the facts, you know. Mm-hmm. I like to compare it to the phrase, the people, or even more, the phrase, we the people, mm-hmm. which without which we would not be who we are, mm-hmm. and to suggest that grassroots is infinitely less ambiguous mm-hmm. than we the people, and therefore perhaps less powerful.
Mm-hmm. One final question requiring a brief answer. Looking back at your career, how would you advise students who don't necessarily want to go into literary scholarship, mm-hmm. but to develop and maintain this critical perspective towards words? To I think in your lectures you use the term to move from words controlling us to our having the power to control them. Yeah.
Well, if I were giving advice to graduate students, I wouldn't be talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about to the public?
The public, for goodness sakes, yeah. don't believe what you're told. And don't believe that the words that are being used to describe where we are neutral words. Mm. When you're told that the surge is a success, what does the use of the word success mean there, and what does it try to do to us? Do we understand what a success is or would be thought of in Iraq? No, but keep on saying it, mm-hmm. and people may forget to look more closely.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Annabelle, thank you very much for taking the time to be on our program and coming to the campus to deliver the Tanner Lectures.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.